Kurzweil Educational Systems have come out with version 7.0 of Kurzweil 1000. Lots of new features, and to talk us through them, we're joined by Stephen Baum. Stephen, welcome back to the program. This version of Kurzweil 1000 has a couple of quite exciting departures, I guess you would say, or new avenues that you're branching into. Can we talk about online access first, and the fact that the K1000 is now to some extent online aware?
Sure, that would be just fine. There is a new menu item, and that is online, and there are three things underneath that, of which the most exciting by far is the ability to search internet repositories that contain books. Right now we look in three different repositories. One is Gutenberg, which is a collection of basically electronic texts that have been in the public domain for some time. A second is Bain Books, which is a relatively small but sort of interesting collection of science fiction literature. And the third is Bookshare.org. Bookshare for people in the United States is probably the most interesting option, but it is certainly a problem elsewhere that Bookshare documents are not necessarily always available.
And my understanding is that version 7 users who are in the United States can get a free 30-day trial of Bookshare as part of the version 7 package.
They can. The people at Bookshare have been very cooperative with us in terms of making this offer available, and also in terms of providing some technology to us that made it possible for us to do what we were going to do. Normally in the United States, if someone does have Bookshare membership, they can use their internet browser to search in the Bookshare website to find the books they're interested in. They can then do a download of those books, and what they end up having is a book in an encrypted format. It's both encrypted and compressed. They then have to run a separate program supplied by Bookshare to unencrypt that book, typically producing a zip file or producing a folder, I believe, that contains a number of files. And then they have to go into yet another application, of course, to read the book. The book would be in DAISY format or in Braille format, grade 2 Braille at that point. We simplify that considerably. You enter the name or partial name of the book that you wish to find, or the name or partial name of the author, or some combination of the two, and you do the search within the Kurzweil 1000. It will come up with a list of books at various sites that you can download. You place a check beside one or more of them and ask the K1000 to do the download, and while that download is occurring, you can continue to do whatever you wish to do in the K1000. The download happens in the background. When it completes, you are given the option of immediately opening what you've downloaded, and we will do the decryption and the reformatting and whatever else may be necessary to open the file. And that's true for all three of the sites that we're looking at.
So in the case of Bookshare, I take it that there's a tie between the encryption process and a given individual's user ID. I guess it's a way of protecting to some degree from the books getting all over the place. Is that how it works?
Yes. The book is encrypted, and you need your password and your user ID in order to decrypt it. And part of our agreement with Bookshare is that we don't remember the password, so whenever it's required, we tend to ask again for the password. So that can happen more than once during this process. One of the things that Bookshare does, which is kind of interesting, is a way of protecting what are, after all, copyrighted books, is that they watermark the books. So even after you have decrypted them, the text you end up with has in subtle ways been changed so that if someone were to violate their subscription agreement and somehow manage to distribute this stuff all over the net, the people at Bookshare could trace back where the information had come from.
So their people will be in touch. Yes. So when you bring these books down in the K1000, my understanding is that one has two options if you are a Bookshare user, to get them in a BRF file or to get them in the DAISY file. Which one are you reading?
DAISY. In this case, I think if you do the download within the Kurzweil 1000, I'm reasonably sure you almost always will get the DAISY version. If you were outside of the Kurzweil 1000 to download the Braille version, that would be fine too. We can open and read either one.
Do you think there'll come a time when the K1000 will understand DAISY audiobooks, so that if ever libraries start to produce full material, such as magazines, say, in full DAISY marked up audio, that the K1000 might handle that at some point?
I certainly think that's possible. I think DAISY ultimately can be a pretty exciting format. We are already in contact with certain European distributors who are planning to make newspapers available in DAISY format, because they want to take advantage of the multi-level navigation capabilities within DAISY. And some of them are asking us to provide mechanisms for reading, for interpreting and reading those within the Kurzweil 1000. So that's certainly a direction we plan to go in. And certainly if a DAISY book has recorded human voice, probably most of us would rather hear that than to hear the electronic voice made by a real speak or a deck talk or a via voice out loud.
Right. And just while we're on the subject of the new online functionality, I noticed that Web Braille isn't there. And for American users, Web Braille is quite a big source of online books, I understand. Is that something that you were looking at adding and for some reason weren't able to, or what's the story there?
Like every release, we don't manage to get in everything we want to get in.
Right.
We're time limited. And we intend certainly to add other sites. Web Braille may well be one of those sites, and we are talking to them. The Web Braille site poses some really interesting challenges in terms of automatically indexing, searching, downloading the appropriate material, and in some cases stitching it together. There are ways in which that site is difficult. But we are certainly looking at that, and we're interested in people's suggestions in general as to what other online repositories of electronic books we should be searching. The fact that we can search any and all of them at the same time makes this a increasingly powerful feature as we add more sites. So that's important to do, to add those sites. And to make a pitch for another online feature, we now have the ability to provide updates online as well. And so if we were to add, for example, access to another online site, you can imagine that that will be available as an update. And again, within the Kurzweil 1000, in this case, you simply would go to the online menu down to the update option, and we will tell you about those updates that are available, which will make sense for your particular version of the Kurzweil 1000. Again, we would download them in the background, and when you exit from the program, we will install them automatically.
Yeah, it's kind of like a very user-friendly version of Windows Update in some respects.
Yeah, perhaps. I think Windows Update is actually pretty friendly itself, except when it tells me to reboot my PC several times.
Yes, fair enough. Now, although it's not in the online menu, one thing that you have also added that makes use of online functionality is the ability to read, or the need really, to register the version 7 product and establish an account with Kurzweil 1000. Is that a response to kind of you've moved back a little from taking away the copy protection to actually trying to stop inappropriate duplication of the product?
Exactly. I mean, that's certainly one reason to do it. We have had piracy in the past that we know about. I will say one of the nice things about this particular community of users is that I think in general when piracy occurs, we find out about it from users who really don't like to see that happen. So we have certainly had circumstances where people have attempted to advertise multiple copies of Kurzweil 1000 at some fee that makes it really quite obvious they're simply not trying to resell the version that they have. And in general, people let us know when that occurs. Online registration makes that at least a little harder in that they now have to have a valid serial number, and ultimately the registration process makes it likely that we will find out what that serial number is and be able to associate it to the person who bought the product. Probably a bigger reason for doing it, though, is simply to be in better touch with our own customer base. One of the problems of selling a product through a dealer network rather than selling it directly is that we don't always know who owns our product. And particularly when we're trying to collect information about what to do next or just when we want to notify people that there's a new release, it's nice to be able to have addresses and names and be able to get that information in, both out to people and in from people.
And it is a fairly user-friendly process, I suppose, particularly if people are already Windows users and they should find no difficulty with going through the registration process.
It's pretty straightforward. You go into the help dialog and press register. You are asked for your serial number. And since we're a scanning program, we figure we ought to be able to scan the serial number. So you can scan the serial number, which is on a particular card that's fairly easy to find because it's one sheet, heavy stock, and I believe the right corner is cut. The serial number is also on the CD case, and I believe it's also on the box that contains the product.
Yeah.
And all three of those are brailled as well as print.
Oh, very good.
So you can scan the serial number. Once you do that, you have three ways to register. You can register online if you have an internet access, and that's certainly the easiest way. You can register by writing a bunch of information to a diskette and then mailing the diskette to us. Or you can register by calling us.
Okay. Another area where I think you're really making some exciting developments with this release is moving into the concept of applications, where really, K1000 is becoming ever more, much more than a scanning OCR package. And I know a lot of people have been using K1000 for a long time to read anyway, to read HTML files or PDF files and all sorts of things. So for many people, it's always been more than an OCR package. But here we are, it's doing faxing now and copying. Can you tell us a little bit about the philosophy behind applications and where you think it's heading?
Sure. Part of the idea is simply that I can only make the user interface in an application so big. Sooner or later, the number of features you add become so many that it becomes very difficult to find them. Certainly, none of us use more than 20% of the functionality of Microsoft Word, I suspect, because there's so much functionality in it that it becomes hard to find, even if you do know that it exists. And there are a lot of tasks that people want to do that ideally could be done by something that's really very small and very simple, and that would be nice to add because they kind of make sense in the context of the Kurzweil 1000, but which can be done better perhaps as separate applications than directly within the 1000. So we have an application folder, which I think is called apps, and it's immediately under the Kurzweil 1000 executable folder. And when there are applications within there, the Kurzweil 1000 itself automatically knows that they are there and can get to them through the launch facility, which has been in the Kurzweil 1000 for some time. The applications we've added so far, as you mentioned, one is a fairly simple fax program that allows you to scan material and send it out as a fax to someone. It also allows you to, it comes with a fax printer, so you can, within, say, Microsoft Word or some other application, decide to send a document as a fax using a fax printer, and that will bring up our fax application. There is You can also, of course, receive a fax with that. And when you do, what that is going to do is create a TIFF file, which will then be available to the Kurzweil 1000 proper to recognize and let you read. There's also a simple photocopier application, which, if you have a printer, allows you to use the combination of the scanner and the printer to make any number of copies of hard copies of a piece of paper that you might want to make. And it will let you scan in binary, grayscale, or color. It gives you a few options for image quality and for resizing, and that's about it.
And so it seems like the boundaries are limitless, really, with respect to things that you might possibly want to add in future releases now that you have the architecture in there for this application system.
Yes, and we certainly welcome people's ideas as to other things. Again, probably relatively small, relatively simple, but things that make sense as self-voicing applications that people might want to have us do. Certainly one of the things that we didn't get around to doing, but that's been on our list just about forever, is an appointment book.
Right. Would you look at making that compatible with other appointment books, for example, Microsoft Outlook, or would this be for people who perhaps are more dedicated K1000 users who just want that functionality without it being synchronized with one of the more standard applications?
Well, certainly one of the reasons we ended up not doing it this time around was because the answer to questions like that is often very, very complicated. Synchronizing with Outlook is a fine idea and something I think would make sense, although you also want to work if you don't have Outlook, and unfortunately you want to deal with the fact that there are any number of versions of Outlook floating around, all of which have to be approached differently. And so it became a very, very complicated thing for us to begin working on. And to be honest, we kind of gave up this release round. Hopefully we'll get to it some later time.
Yes, well, it's not as if you've been idle. There's a lot of new stuff. And while we've been featuring at the moment some of the really big things, you've also made a lot of improvements that may not be quite as noticeable as soon as you run the product for the first time. But there are some significant additions. For example, you've got the latest FineReader OCR engine. Do you think that will make a substantive difference that people will notice?
I'm not entirely sure how to answer that. I do think its accuracy is better, but it is not as dramatically better as the difference between Fine Engine 4 and 5, which was really pronounced. The difference between 5 and 6 is, I would say, considerably more subtle. They've added a few more languages. They're up to 177 recognition languages, which is some kind of record. I didn't necessarily know that that many languages existed. They've added recognition for three new fonts. They've added OCRA, OCRB, and MICR, M-I-C-R, which is, for those of us who have been in the OCR business a long time, kind of an amusing thing to do. Because, of course, OCRA and OCRB were invented many years ago when OCR could only handle synthetic fonts that were designed in order to be read by OCR programs. And OCRA and OCRB and MICR, to a lesser extent, were invented to be read by machines. And now that OCR products read typeset and typewritten material, the only fonts they couldn't read were the synthetic fonts that originally had been invented for OCR. So they've added those, and it's kind of amusing. They've also, the other thing they added is, and this is actually a quote from their documentation. They say, an improved algorithm for the recognition of poor print quality documents.
Beautiful.
The improved algorithm incorporates a new adaptive image binarization method and a new method of background removal and is particularly effective in the case of images scanned in gray mode.
Okay.
So one of the things we added in this release is the ability to pass grayscale data from the scanner directly to the OCR product itself and let it deal with it.
Right, so now you've got dynamic thresholding and static thresholding in grayscale, I think, are the options. Can you tell us when would you use which one? Is there a particular incident in which you might choose one over the other?
If the speed of scanning and recognition is important to you and the document is reasonably high quality, then static thresholding is the fastest to use. And certainly, the other thing is that if the document is consistent from page to page, you are likely, although not always going to be able to do this, but you are likely with static recognition to be able to fine-tune the brightness setting so that you can get very, very good accuracy, and potentially better than you can get with dynamic or grayscale. If, however, the material you are scanning is relatively poor quality or changes from page to page, and this, by the way, the changes can include things like funny colored backgrounds. So magazines, for example, even though they're high quality, are inconsistent from page to page. In those sorts of circumstances, dynamic or grayscale is likely to be better. And dynamic thresholding is somewhat faster than grayscale. Grayscale is the slowest option, but every once in a while you will find a document where it's very, very good. Personally, I would tend to stick with static or dynamic. Grayscale, I think, frankly, fine readers still have some work to do. But it is an option that's available, and there are times where it's really quite handy.
Yeah, it is worth people reading the manual, where I think there's a very good explanation in there about how to adjust your brightness settings, because if people take the time to get that right, it's quite astounding how accurate the results can be.
It can certainly make a big difference.
What else have we got? Well, MP3 encoding has changed a little bit in this release, and I suspect a lot of people will find this much easier to start working with now.
Probably. For licensing reasons, we did not include an MP3 encoder in our product. Basically, we could have, had we been willing to pay a considerable amount for the MP3 encoder for everyone. And since from our perspective it seemed like a feature that some people would use and others would not, and a feature that when people would use it, odds are they already had an MP3 encoder, we weren't sort of willing to spend the money on everyone's copy of an MP3 encoder. As a consequence, we went with a MP3 encoder that was readily downloadable from the Internet and basically gave people instructions indicating that they could find it if they needed to find it, if they wanted to find it. With this version, we're taking advantage of the fact that Microsoft has included an MP3 encoder in most of the versions of their operating system. And if you don't have that MP3 encoder, you can still download it from Microsoft simply by downloading
I think it might be the Windows Media Tools.
Exactly. Yeah. Windows Media Tools, even the Media Player typically will have it. And so it becomes fairly easy for people to find and use it. So the change we made for this release is fairly simple. It's just that we will now use the Microsoft MP3 encoders.
Yeah, I actually think it sounds a bit better as well.
Oh, do you? Okay,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's using the Fraunhofer encoder, which in my view is better at low bit rates than LAME, so very good move all around.
Good.
Now, when you introduced bookmarks for the first time, I can't even remember in what version that came up, but I was doing my master's thesis at that stage, and I just couldn't believe how useful the bookmark feature was. Now you've taken it, as we say, to the next level in this release.
Quite literally to the next level, in that what we've added is a new property, which is a level number. And the level number can be used, it doesn't have to be used, but it can be used to indicate a position within a hierarchy. So, for example, you might use level 1 for chapter breaks in a book, and then you could use level 2 for subchapters, level 3 for subchapters, etc., and we will go as far down as level 6. The one example of how this feature works can be found in our online manual, which now has an extensive set of bookmarks that are hierarchical. And if you use the go to bookmark command, one view of bookmarks is as a hierarchical tree, essentially as an outline. Another thing that you can do with this, which is can be quite nice now, is that you can create a what's called a summary in the product using file summary. And if there are bookmarks in the document, it will ask if you wish to use the bookmarks. If you answer yes, what it will produce is a text file which is in fact an indented outline, which will start with 1.0 and then 1.1 and 1.1.1, etc., and will then have the description of your bookmark and at the end a parenthesis page number as to what page that is to be on. And the parentheses, I have to admit, is an innovation that came from my son, who is in high school and is writing research papers on a regular basis. And that happened to be the format that he was told to use when he was doing references. So I thought it might be useful for some other people somewhere.
Very good. Is there a correlation at this stage between your support for DAISY and multi-level bookmarks? Because I know that DAISY does contain markup information that allows you to zap to different parts of the book, say by chapter or page, depending on how the book is marked up. Is there that kind of relationship at this stage?
That is why we have 6 levels of bookmarks, although the answer is that at this stage, there is no such relationship. We have yet to add the ability when we convert from a DAISY file to a KES file. We have not yet at this point added the ability to take their navigation and turn that into our style of bookmarks. Or in the reverse, going from a KES file ultimately to a DAISY file, which is a direction you can't really do very well right now but would be nice to do in the future, we would again like to be able to go from our bookmarks into the DAISY hierarchy. We haven't done it yet. It's absolutely in the works. That's one of the things we certainly intend to do.
And speaking of creating other file formats, you've really got to speed with the latest and greatest in terms of file conversions now. There doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot that I can think of that Kurzweil can't open and save now.
Let's see, I have run into a few things I couldn't, but not many. What did I... Oh, yes, I was trying to open an OmniPage form recently, OmniForm.
Okay.
They have a format called OMF, and guess what? We don't support it. yes, we support well over 100 different formats, and we support more current versions of those formats than we used to. Not necessarily always the latest version, which can be rather tricky because, of course, the people who write conversions are in a constant battle of trying to keep up with the people who write the applications and modify those formats. But nonetheless, we've added a number of new formats, particularly ones to handle newer versions of WordPerfect, of Word, of other Office products.
All right. Those were the main things I could think of. Is there anything that stands out in version 7 that you want to tell us about that I've missed?
Let's see. I've got in front of me a new features list, which, I'll try to move quickly. Re-recognize all pages. And one reason why that could be handy is imagine that you scanned a book using... an older version of our product, and you retained images, and you discover that a newer recognition engine of ours might, in fact, do a better job. You could simply open that file, indicate that you wish to re-recognize all the pages, go get a cup of coffee, and when you're back, they've all been re-recognized using the newer version of our engine. So that's a new feature, and occasionally handy. Voice emphasis, the ability to switch to the message voice when you're reading bolded, italicized, or underlined text. SAPI 5 support. The ability to, we no longer include FlexTalk. Instead, we include IBM ViaVoice. And we do so in all its various languages. So there's U.S. English, U.K. English, French, German, Italian, Spanish, Brazilian Portuguese, and Finnish.
I've got to ask you about that, because there's sort of a love-hate thing that goes on with that speech. You didn't find anything better? Many people were wondering whether the AT&T Natural Voices might be an option, for example.
As it is right now, we try to include an example of two types of engines. One type will run on a relatively underpowered processor, you know, a Pentium, but certainly not necessarily a current Pentium. And the other type, which in general will be more natural sounding, will run on a relatively high-end system. And right now, our high-end system voice is RealSpeak. I do think AT&T Natural Voices is giving it a run for its money, but AT&T Natural Voices requires actually a higher-end processor to get reasonable speech than does RealSpeak. Mm. RealSpeak actually is somewhat more responsive on a slower machine than is AT&T Natural Voices, which requires an enormous amount of memory to run well. And as to which one actually sounds better, the jury is still out. There are people who will argue both cases.
Yeah.
I find the prosodics, which is the rise and fall of a voice, to be somewhat worse in AT&T Natural Voices, but the smoothness of the voice to be somewhat better. Yeah. So I think it can go both ways. Certainly, we always evaluate other languages as they come out, or other speech engines as they come out. And we've, you know, actively participated in beta programs for AT&T Natural Voices. It's really the big reason we added SAPI 5, for example. And then they surprised us by coming out with a SAPI 4 version. But and we're looking at other speech engines as well on a regular basis.
Mm. So, because you can get AT&T Natural Voices in a number of ways, I think. For example, the text.rdmp3 program, I think it's called, will give you the SAPI-compliant version, so you could use it with Kurzweil if you have it.
And it does work quite well with it.
Mm. Right?
And one of the really nice things about it, and something I think other speech vendors ought to be encouraged to do, is the fact that they do make it available directly themselves at a not completely unreasonable price, and they've also made it available through relatively inexpensive applications, which is something you haven't seen much for other speech engines, which often can be very difficult to get directly, and you often end up having to get a product like ours or like our competitors in order to get access to them.
Yeah, and it seems to me that there's really now a lot of work in making speech more intelligible for all sorts of non-blindness-related applications. So speech engines like Eloquence, which are really designed for snappiness, which is what we look for in cranking them right up and still having them intelligible, they may be a dying breed, perhaps.
Well, they're at least becoming, there are fewer of them, and the number of choices that exist are relatively small. And some of them that still do exist weren't being improved at a regular rate. So, yeah, unfortunately, that is becoming somewhat harder to find.
All right, and it's very snappy, though, with Natural Voices, isn't it? It's quite responsive indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, let's continue through the new features list.
Okay, and stop me whenever you will.
I will.
We've added some additional support for hardware speech synthesizers in that modern operating systems such as NT, Windows 2000, and XP, we found it difficult to support SSIL with those operating systems. So we now directly support DeckTalk Express, DoubleTalk LT, and TripleTalk. And the TripleTalk support, by the way, at the moment seems to work great for the USB version of that product, and we are still having problems, which we're working with the vendor who makes TripleTalk regarding the PCI version. And okay. So we directly support those particular speech engines now.
Great.
We now support yet another way of accessing a scanner, and for a number of years we've had three different ways: HP, SCL, HP Accupage, and Twain. We've added Windows Image Acquisition, or WIA, which is a Microsoft standard available for Windows ME, Windows 2000, and XP. I might add we have yet to come up with a good reason for using WIA as your approach rather than Twain, but we suspect someday a reason will emerge, i.e. a scanner will come out that has reasonable WIA support and not a very good Twain interface.
It's good to play with that setting, though, in the sense that sometimes you get yourself in a situation where some other application is stealing the focus away from Cursor 1000, which makes it difficult to do what I like doing best, which is to sit back with a book and scan several pages ahead while you're actually listening to the book. So you've really got to just keep playing, and when you find something that doesn't steal the focus, save that setting before you lose it.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And WIA... Since WIA is really designed to be used by applications without bringing up its own UI, it's not likely to steal focus. It's likely to behave itself better in that regard.
Mm.
We've added another scanner resolution, 600 dots per inch. It will slow things down considerably, but if you like to read CD liner notes, it may be the only way you can read them well.
Right, okay, so let's talk about the DPI thing. Is 300 generally what you should leave it on unless you have a specific reason to change it, and when would you change it?
Yes, I would say 300 is a very good default. However, suppose what you're scanning is not is a very high-quality laser-printed office document, and you have a lot of it to scan, and it's very, very good quality. If you're like me and everybody else, the time that you're spending scanning, you sort of spend begrudgingly, even though you can listen to the text while you scan. The scanning itself is an annoyance that you have to get through. If you scan at 200 DPI, your scanner will go considerably faster. So for very high-quality material, it might be worth trying 200 DPI and seeing if the accuracy is still good enough. You might find it's just fine and that you can scan quite quickly. So sometimes 200 dots per inch is a really good setting. 300 is probably a good default. 400 every now and then will be much better. And in general, you want to use something like 400 when the size of the print gets to, say, 7 point or below. And that is something you can find out in the Kurzweil 1000 by scanning a page. And then when you get to something that looks difficult to read, checking what the point size is, which you can do with, if I can remember this, I believe it's Control-Shift-F. Or you can go into the edit dialog under format and look at the character size there.
Right.
So that becomes useful occasionally for that. And 600, as I say, is very rare, but people do tell me that it helps for reading things like liner notes or probably the fine print of certain contracts.
Oh, very important, that. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Let's see. Also under the online menu, we have the ability to get news from KESI. And frankly, we haven't written any useful news yet, but the intent is that this is a good way for us to keep in touch with our customer base. And also another way besides the very well-used Kurzweil 1000 listserv to send information to other people. If people have articles regarding pretty much anything that they happen to want to publish in a way that gets to other Kurzweil 1000 users, send them to us. We might very well put them on under news from KESI, and other people can download them you can become a published author that way.
Cool.
So that might be fun.
Okay.
Send to email. That's actually quite useful.
Yes, indeed.
This is a new option under the send to menu item, which is under the file menu. And basically we've added another device that you can send to, but this is a virtual rather than a physical device, and it's titled an email recipient. You can send a document or part of a document to an email recipient using your email program. We still don't provide any email application ourselves, and sort of have no intention of doing so, but we can send, we can interact with your email client, be it, well, hopefully pretty much anyone you can think of. And if you find you have an email client that we're not working with, let us know and we'll try to add support for it later. But basically you can send a file as an attachment, as a zipped attachment, or as text within the message itself. You can indicate the email address or addresses you want to send it to, and when you exercise this option, we will convert the file to the format you wish us to convert it to, if it's an attachment, and then bring up your email application. You would finish within that application, hit send, and then go back to the Kurzweil 1000.
Brilliant.
So that's in there. Ranked spelling. This is one. One reason I added this is that my own use of spell checkers is I find I'm very impatient in using them, particularly when the document has been scanned. Yes, you can improve the accuracy of the document, but you're likely to give up after the first two pages, or at least I am. I'm not very good at working my way through an entire document with a spell checker. So what the intent of this is to optimize your time when you use a spell checker by having you fix the high-frequency misspellings first. So this is a new tool under the Tools menu. It's called Ranked Spelling, and it takes a little time before it comes up. But when it comes up, it will give you a list of all the misspellings in your document in the order of how often they occur. And for each one, you can do what you would do in a spell checker. You can add a word to the dictionary, ignore it for the document, replace it throughout the document with something else, which also adds a correction. So this becomes a way to spell check your, that allows you to make the important decisions first. It also gives you a summary that some people find useful, which is a percentage of the correct words in the document.
And that's quite a novel idea.
Yeah, it was kind of new. It was actually suggested in part by a beta tester, who actually what he asked for was the percentage of correct words, and we went somewhat beyond that because we thought this might actually prove to be useful. I think, like a lot of our features, it's one that will change as we make new releases. There are probably other ways in which we can make this more useful, but nonetheless, as it is, it gives you a very systematic look at a document, which, by the way, is particularly important when what you want to do is create corrections lists.
Yes, indeed.
Because it's better to be systematic about that.
Hmm.
We can now save partial documents. So that simply allows you to save a range of page numbers, if you wish to do that.
Okay.
You can search backwards, something people have asked for a long time.
Yes.
So now you can use Shift F3 and search backwards, or you can shift backwards in both the Find and the Replace dialog with options in there. And while we were in there, we simplified the ability to search for things like bolded text and italicized text. We've added more file properties, including a count of the number of pages, paragraphs, words, and characters. Let's see, the installation has changed.
Yes, it has.
You now have a choice between a voiced install that is somewhat like what we already have and a standard install, which is using the current version of Install Shield. Let's see. What else? Common file dialog. This has been a controversial part of the Kurzweil 1000 from the beginning.
Yes, I can't believe I overlooked that one to talk to you about. Yeah.
Yeah. We have always gone our own way with file dialogs, and it's largely because the, in quote, standard file dialog, which isn't necessarily all that standard, but is largely in use, which is really, I think, more precisely called a common file dialog. The common file dialog is really ill-suited, I think, to keyboard use. I think, although it works, it has some real problems. However, it is what people get accustomed to using, and so we thought it would be nice to make that available. So now there is a configuration setting dialog. One of the options within it is to choose between using our file dialog or the common file dialog. And it isn't a imitation of the common file dialog, it is the real common file dialog. And we have added some capabilities that are similar to what a screen reader would do that allow us to speak that dialog. However, since we always tend to do things with a twist, in addition to speaking it, we magnify it. So for people with low vision, it won't necessarily look like the file, common file dialog. It'll look bigger, but nonetheless, it is the common file dialog.
Right. Okay. You don't speak yet control types. Is that a deliberate decision so that people don't automatically hear that they're dealing with radio buttons or combo boxes or list views?
That's something that's asked for again and again, and again and again I managed to not do it. One reason is because if I had that option, I wouldn't use it. Now, that's sort of silly because I'm sighted. Why would I want to? But my sense of it is it makes the voice much more computery. It makes everything sound less friendly when I have that. And it's always struck me that it's information that I want occasionally, but not very often. So right now you can get that information by pressing F1, although I do admit you have to listen to a lengthy help message sometimes to get the information you want. Nonetheless, I ought to bow to the wisdom of the users and actually add this, although I would certainly add it as an option.
Right, yes.
I don't have it in there yet.
Okay.
Let's see. You in the print dialog, you can now print an image if you wish to.
Okay.
Not a big deal, but it's there. And that's really most everything. A lot of the other things are really very subtle, like a subtle one that's handy for people who use scan multilingual documents is that an individual settings dialog can control multiple sets of speech parameters for the reading voice. So that if you switch reading voices automatically, as the product can do when it identifies a new language, it will also automatically adjust the speed and the pitch so that they are closer to what you want. So that's subtle, something most people would never notice, but it's new. Also to do with settings, you can save partial settings, which is a rather obscure idea, but quite handy. Suppose you get Via Voice Eloquence on your system, or Via Voice Out Loud, pardon me, and you decide that you actually like Reed, and Reed is what you want to use for your reading voice from now on. However, you have a dozen or so settings files, and you would like to change them all. In the past, the way you would have to do that would be to load each settings file, change the voice, and the other associated settings you might want to change, and then save them over that existing settings file, and do that again, and do it 8 or 9 times. Now you can do it quite quickly. You just save partial settings, indicate the category of settings you wish to save, select the settings files that you want to save over, and you can select any number of them. You can use Control-A if you wish to select them all, and then save. And that will update just the appropriate type category of setting rather than all settings.
Very good. You've also got a screen reader keypad option now.
Yeah, and to be honest, I haven't gotten as much feedback on it as I would like, so I'm not sure in many respects how well it works. But basically, I wanted to make a keypad layout that would be much more, much friendlier for someone who was a JFW user. And so when you are in what we call the reading keypad level, you can choose to use an alternative keypad layout that I think is rather JAWS-like. It may not be entirely JAWS-like. I may have missed a few things, but my intent certainly was to make it as JAWS-like as possible, and I'd love someone to tell me what's wrong if there is something wrong. As I say, I'm a little uncertain about that feature, but the feature exists, and I think there are people who will find it handy.
Okay. Gosh, there's a lot of stuff in there, isn't there? And what about the pattern of releases? Because you guys used to be as regular as clockwork, coming out with a couple of releases. I think it was even a year at one point.
Yeah, we used to do two releases a year, and we would have a 0.0 and a 0.5. I think we did that. I think we did that for two or three years. I forget. Perhaps three. We are more likely to be at a release a year, and the primary reason for that is that this is really a pretty mature product. It's got a lot of functionality in it already, and I'm frankly just less likely to find something that I absolutely have to have in there within a six-month time period. There are things that could make us do a 0.5 release, so I can't preclude the possibility entirely that it would happen. For example, if ExpertVision came out with the next release of their OCR product, of their OCR toolkit, and we found it just really compelling, I could imagine that we would do a release in 6 months instead of a release in a year in order to get at that out to people as quickly as we could. But I think in general we're more likely to do a release a year. I will point out, though, that we do have this online upgrade capability, and we do intend to use that for more than bug fixes. So if we provide, for example, enhancements to certain applications, or possibly an entirely new application, or new websites that we search when we're searching online books, I expect things like that you might very well see in online upgrades, which are free to anyone who has this version of the Kurzweil 1000.
So how much does it cost to upgrade from to the new version 7 from the previous release?
Our policy is that we don't care what release you have. The price is the same, and it's $95.
Right.
So in general, any upgrade is $95. If you received or if you purchased the existing your copy of the Kurzweil 1000 within the last year, and by purchase I don't mean an update but rather the full product within the last year, then you should receive an update for free. And if you do not, you should check in with us.
Is there a demo option available for people who might like to try all these new features and are not presently a K1000 user?
Oh, certainly. Again, they would get in touch with us, which they can do from our website, or they can do by calling us. And I suppose I should provide a number if only I can remember it. But you may want to do that at the end, perhaps. But basically, you would call and ask for a demo. We will send out a demo CD free of charge. And our demos now last for 2 hours rather than 1 hour. Before you are asked to exit and enter the product again. But they still last for 30 days from the point when you first use the product.
Will you ever make that downloadable with the number of broadband connections that now seem to be out there?
We did, in fact, make the previous version downloadable.
Okay.
And to be honest, it wasn't downloaded that often. So we're at least contemplating doing it again, but we haven't at this point. There's one thing that we don't like about doing a downloadable version, which is that invariably you do have to leave some things out. It would be, we could easily do a 300 megabyte download, and I don't think anyone would be terribly interested. We try to keep it under, say, 100 megabytes if we can, but that does mean we don't always show the product to its full advantage. There always end up being things that have to be left out for us to make that possible.
And you've just launched a new website, so if people haven't been there for a while, they may get a surprise when they go back and find that it's revamped and has a lot more information there.
It does. The website was launched just last week, and I'd also appreciate people's comments as to what's there, what isn't there, and how easy it is to use. We've certainly tried to make it as user-friendly as we can, and we have gone through the process of Bobby certification and all those sorts of things. So it is at least reasonably friendly to screen readers, but if there are ways in which we can make it more friendly, we'd like to hear about that.
And the URL for that?
That's http kurzweil.edu.com. And that middle word is KURZWEIL.edu. If that word is too long for you, and frankly it's often too long for me, it has always been our intent that you can also use kesi.com, which is a domain we also own. So it is possible that a URL of www.kesi.com will work as well. And I say that somewhat conditionally because it seems to be very hard to keep that mirror site up and going. It works, but it doesn't always work.
All right. And people can find all sorts of contact information for various departments of Kurzweil Educational Systems on the website as well.
They can, although I think I should provide a few of the obvious numbers.
Good.
There is a toll-free number, which obviously works only in the U.S. and Canada, for customer support. That is 888-995-9905. If you do not have access to a toll-free number, you would call 781-276-0600, and you will get the usual inevitable telephone tree of options. One of them will be customer support. That is also the way to get to customer service, although you can also call, again, if you can, an 800 number or a direct number. That number is a toll-free number. That number, too, works in Canada as well as in the United States and is 800-894-5374.
Brilliant. Well, congratulations on a very busy and full-featured release, and we'll look forward to talking with you about version 7.5 or version 8 in the future.
Sure. I look forward to it.